Chapter 23. Whenever you give the interviewer a fact, he said, give him another fact that will contradict it. Then he'll go away with a jumble that he can't use at all. Be gentle, be sweet, smile like an idiot, just be natural. That's what my friend told me to do, and I did it. Where were you born? Asked the interviewer. Well, hooray, I began, I was born in Alabama, or Alaska, or the Sandwich Islands. I don't know where, but right around there somewhere. And you had better put it down before you forget it. But you weren't born in all those places, he said. Well, I've offered you three places. Take your choice. They're all at the same price. How old are you? He asked. I shall be 19 in June, I said. Why, there's such a discrepancy between your age and your looks, he said. Oh, that's nothing, I said, I was born discrepantly. Then we got to talking about my brother Samuel, and he told me my explanations were confusing. I suppose he is dead, I said. Ohm said that he was dead, and some said that he wasn't. Did you bury him without knowing whether he was dead or not? Asked the reporter. There was a mystery, said one. We were twins, and one day when we were 2 weeks old, that is, he was 1 week old, and I was 1 week old, we got mixed up in the bathtub, and one of us drowned. We never could tell which. One of us had a strawberry birthmark on the back of his hand. There it is on my hand. This is the one that was drowned. There's no doubt about it. Where's the mystery? He said. Why, don't you see how stupid it was to bury the wrong twin? I answered. I didn't explain it anymore, because he said the explanation confused him. To me it is perfectly plain. But, to get back to Fulton. I'm going along like an old man I used to know who used to start to tell a story about his grandfather. He had an awfully retentive memory, and he never finished the story, because he switched off into something else. He used to tell about how his grandfather one day went into a pasture, where there was a ram. The old man dropped a silver dime in the grass, and stooped over to pick it up. The ram was observing him, and took the old man's action as an invitation. Just as he was going to finish about the ram, this friend of mine would recall that his grandfather had a niece who had a glass eye. She used to loan that glass eye to another lady friend, who used it when she received company. The eye didn't fit the friend's face, and it was loose. And whenever she winked it would turn over. Then he got on the subject of accidents, and he would tell a story about how he believed accidents never happened. There was an Irishman coming down a ladder with a hod of bricks, he said, and a Dutchman was standing on the ground below. The Irishman fell on the Dutchman and killed him. Accident? Never. If the Dutchman hadn't been there, the Irishman would have been killed. Why didn't the Irishman fall on a dog which was next to the Dutchman? Because the dog would have seen him coming. Then he'd get off from the Dutchman to an uncle named Reginald Wilson. Reginald went into a carpet factory one day and got twisted into the machinery's belt. He went excursioning around the factory until he was properly distributed, and was woven into 69 yards of the best 3-ply carpet. His wife bought the carpet, and then she erected a monument to his memory. It read, sacred to the memory of 69 yards of the best 3-ply carpet containing the mortal remainders of Reginald Wilson, go thou, and do likewise, and so and he would ramble about telling the story of his grandfather until we never were told whether he found the 10-cent piece, or whether something else happened. Fulton Day, Jamestown, address delivered September 23, 1907, Lieutenant Governor Ellison, of Virginia, in introducing Mr. Clemens, said. He people have come here to bring a tribute of affectionate recollection for the man who has contributed so much to the progress of the world and the happiness of mankind. As Mr. Clemens came down to the platform, the applause became louder and louder, until Mr. Clemens held out his hand for silence. It was a great triumph, and it was almost a minute after the applause ceased before Mr. Clemens could speak. He attempted it once, and when the audience noticed his emotion, it cheered again loudly. Ladies and gentlemen, I am but human, and when you give me a reception like that, I am obliged to wait a little while I get my voice. When you appeal to my head, I don't feel it, but when you appeal to my heart, I do feel it. We are here to celebrate one of the greatest events of American history, and not only in American history, but in the world's history. Indeed, it was the application of steam by Robert Fulton. It was a world event. There are not many of them. It is peculiarly an American event, that is true, but the influence was very broad in effect. We should regard this day as a very great American holiday. We have not many that are exclusively American holidays. We have the 4th of July, which we regard as an American holiday, but it is nothing of the kind. I am waiting for a dissenting voice. All great efforts that led up to the 4th of July were made, not by Americans, but by English residents of America, subjects of the King of England. They fought all the fighting that was done, they shed and spilt all the blood that was spilt, in securing to us the inviolable liberties which are incorporated in the Declaration of Independence. But they were not Americans. They signed the Declaration of Independence. No American's name is signed to that document at all. There never was an American such as you and I are until after the Revolution, when it had all been fought out and liberty secured, after the adoption of the Constitution, and the recognition of the independence of America by all powers. While we revere the 4th of July, and let us always revere it, and the liberties it conferred upon us, yet it was not an American event, a great American day. It was an American who applied that steam successfully. There are not a great many world events, and we have our full share. The telegraph, telephone, and the application of steam to navigation, these are great American events. Today I have been requested, or I have requested myself, not to confine myself to furnishing you with information, but to remind you of things, and to introduce one of the nation's celebrants. Admiral Harrington here is going to tell you all that I have left untold. I am going to tell you all that I know, and then he will follow up with such rags and remnants as he can find, and tell you what he knows. No doubt you have heard a great deal about Robert Fulton and the influences that have grown from his invention, but the little steamboat is suffering neglect. You probably do not know a great deal about that boat. It was the most important steamboat in the world. I was there and saw it. Admiral Harrington was there at the time. It need not surprise you, for he is not as old as he looks. That little boat was interesting in every way. The size of it. The boat was one, consults Admiral, he said 10 feet long. The breadth of that boat, consults Admiral, 200 feet. You see, the first and most important detail is the length, then the breadth, and then the depth. The depth of that boat was, consults again, the Admiral says it was a flat boat. Then her tonnage, you know nothing about a boat until you know two more things. Her speed and her tonnage. We know the speed she made. She made 4 miles dash and sometimes 5 miles. It was on her initial trip, on August 11, 1807, that she made her initial trip, when she went from, consults Admiral, Jersey City to Chicago. That's right. She went by way of Albany. Now comes the tonnage of that boat. Tonnage of a boat means the amount of displacement. Displacement means the amount of water a vessel can shove in a day. The tonnage of man is estimated by the amount of whiskey he can displace in a day. Robert Fulton named the Clermont in honor of his bride, that is, Clermont was the name of the county seat. I feel that it surprises you that I know so much. In my remarks of welcome of Admiral Harrington, I am not going to give him compliments. Compliments always embarrass a man. You do not know anything to say. It does not inspire you with words. There is nothing you can say in answer to a compliment. I have been complimented myself a great many times, and they always embarrass me. I always feel that they have not said enough. The Admiral and myself have held public office, and were associated together a great deal a friendly way in the time of Pocahontas. That incident where Pocahontas saves the life of Smith from her father, Poetin's club, was gotten up by the Admiral and myself to advertise Jamestown. At that time the Admiral and myself did not have the facilities of advertising that you have. I have known Admiral Harrington in all kinds of situations in public service, on the platform, and in the chain gang now, and then, but it was a mistake. A case of mistaken identity. I do not think it is at all a necessity to tell you Admiral Harrington's public history. You know that it is in the histories. I am not here to tell you anything about his public life, but to expose his private life. I am something of a poet. When the great poet laureate, Tennyson, died, and I found that the place was open, I tried to get it, but I did not get it. Anybody can write the first line of a poem, but it is a very difficult task to make the second line rhyme with the first. When I was down in Australia, there were two towns named Johnswood and Param. I made this rhyme. The people of Johnswood are pious and good. The people of Param, they don't care. I do not want to compliment Admiral Harrington, but as long as such men as he devote their lives to the public service, the credit of the country will never cease. I will say that the same high qualities, the same moral and intellectual attainments, the same graciousness of manner, of conduct, of observation, and expression have caused Admiral Harrington to be mistaken for me, and I have been mistaken for him. A mutual compliment can go no further, and I now have the honor and privilege of introducing to you Admiral Harrington. Lodo's Club Dinner in honor of Mark Twain, address at the first formal dinner in the new clubhouse, November 11, 1893, in introducing the guest of the evening, Mr. Lawrence said. Oh night, the old faces appear once more amid new surroundings. The place where last we met about the table has vanished, and tonight we have our first Lodo's dinner in a home that is all our own. It is peculiarly fitting that the board should now be spread in honor of one who has been a member of the club for full a score of years, and it is a happy augury for the future that our fellow member whom we assemble to greet should be the bearer of a most distinguished name in the world of letters. For the Lodo's Club is ever at its best when paying homage to genius in literature or in art. Is there a civilized being who has not heard the name of Mark Twain? We knew him long years ago, before he came out of the boundless West, brimful of wit and eloquence, with no reverence for anything, and went abroad to educate the untutored European in the subtleties of the American joke. The world has looked on and applauded, while he has broken many images. He has led us in imagination all over the globe. With him as our guide, we have traversed alike the Mississippi and the Sea of Galilee. At his bidding we have laughed at 1,000 absurdities. By a laborious process of reasoning he has convinced us that the Egyptian mummies are actually dead. He has held us spellbound upon the plain at the foot of the great Sphinx, and we have joined him in weeping bitter tears at the tomb of Adam. Tonight we greet him in the flesh. What name is there in literature that can be likened to his? Perhaps some of the distinguished gentlemen about this table can tell us, but I know of none. Himself his only parallel. Mr. President, gentlemen, and my fellow members of the Lodo's Club, I have seldom in my lifetime listened to compliments so felicitously phrased or so well deserved. I return thanks for them from a full heart and an appreciative spirit, and I will say this in self-defense. While I am charged with having no reverence for anything, I wish to say that I have reverence for the man who can utter such truths, and I also have a deep reverence, and a sincere one for a club that can do such justice to me. To be the chief guest of such a club is something to be envied, and if I read your countenances rightly, I am envied. I am glad to see this club in such palatial quarters. I remember it 20 years ago, when it was housed in a stable. Now when I was studying for the ministry there were two or three things that struck my attention particularly. At the first banquet mentioned in history, that other prodigal son who came back from his travels was invited to stand up and have his say. They were all there, his brethren, David, and Goliath, and Ur, and if he had had such experience as I have had, he would have waited until those other people got through talking. He got up and testified to all his failings. Now if he had waited, before telling all about his riotous living until the others had spoken, he might not have given himself away as he did, and I think that I would give myself away if I should go on. I think I'd better wait until the others hand in their testimony. Then if it is necessary for me to make an explanation, I will get up and explain, and if I cannot do that, I'll deny it happened. Later in the evening Mr. Clemens made another speech, replying to a fire of short speeches by Charles Dudley Warner, Charles A. Donna, Seth Lowe, General Porter, and many others, each welcoming the guest of honor. I don't see that I have a great deal to explain. I got off very well. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.